having a series of blinding headaches going back 18 months or so. Dr. Willard examined her using one of the latest Rentgen machines and determined that she appeared to have the makings of a tumor upon her brain. Naturally, this placed her under notification, subject to the Monster Control Act, 1864. She was taken to the isolation ward at St. Bartholomew's in London, where 3 weeks, 6 migraines, and 2 seizures later, she experienced her first grand mal fit. After receiving confirmation that she was suffering from acute gorgonism, Dr. Rutherford asked me to proceed as agreed upon, and so I arranged for the Home Office to be contacted by way of the Dean. While Mr. McKenna was at first unenthusiastic about the prospect of a gorgon running about the streets of Manchester, our reassurances ultimately proved acceptable, and he directed that Subject C be released into our custody on her own cognizance. She was in a state of entirely understandable distress when she arrived, but once the situation was explained, she agreed to cooperate fully in return for a settlement which will be made upon her next of kin. As she is young and healthy, she may survive for several months, if not a year, in her current condition. This offers an unparalleled research opportunity. We are currently keeping her in the old leprosarium, the windows of which have been bricked up. A security labyrinth has been installed, the garden wall raised by 5 feet so that she can take in the air without endangering passers-by, and we have arranged a set of signals whereby she can don occlusive blindfolds before receiving visitors. Experiments upon patients with acute gorgonism always carry an element of danger, but in this case I believe our precautions will suffice until her final deterioration begins. Lest you ask why we don't employ a common basilisk or cockatrice instead, I hasten to explain that we do. The pathology is identical in whichever species, but a human source is far more amenable to control than any wild animal. Using Subject C, we can perform repeatable experiments at will, and obtain verbal confirmation that she has performed our requests. I hardly need to remind you that the historical use of gorgonism, for example by Danton's Committee for Public Safety during the French Revolution, was hardly conducted as a scientific study of the phenomenon. This time, we will make progress. Once Subject C was comfortable, Dr. Rutherford arranged a series of seminars. The New Zealander is of the opinion that the effect is probably mediated by some electromagnetic phenomenon of a type unknown to other areas of science. He is consequently soliciting new designs for experiments intended to demonstrate the scope and nature of the Gorgon effect. We know from the history of Mademoiselle Marianne's grisly collaboration with Robespierre that the victim must be visible to the Gorgon, but need not be directly perceived. Reflection works, as does trivial refraction, and the effect is transmitted through glass thin enough to see through. But the Gorgon cannot work in darkness or thick smoke. Nobody has demonstrated a physical mechanism for Gorgonism that doesn't involve an unfortunate creature afflicted with the characteristic tumors. Blinding a Gorgon appears to control the effect, as does a sufficient visual distortion. So why does Ernest insist on treating a clearly biological phenomenon as one of the greatest mysteries in physics today? My dear fellow, he explained to me the first time I asked, how did Madame Curie infer the existence of radioactivity in radium-bearing ores? How did Wilhelm Röntgen recognize X-rays for what they were? Neither of those forms of radiation arose within our current understanding of magnetism, electricity, or light. They had to be something else. Now, our children of Medusa apparently need to behold a victim in order to injure them. But how is the effect transmitted? We know, unlike the ancient Greeks, that our eyes work by focusing ambient light on a membrane at their rear. They used to think that the Gorgons shone forth beams of balefire, as if to set in stone whatever they alighted on. But we know that cannot be true. What we face is nothing less than a wholly new phenomenon. Granted, the Gorgon effect only changes whatever the Medusoid can see directly, but we know the light reflected from those bodies isn't responsible, and Lavoisier's calorimetric experiments before he met his unfortunate end before the looking-glass of l'exécutrice, proved that actual atomic transmutation is going on. So what on earth mediates the effect? How can the act of observation, performed by an unfortunate afflicted with Gorgonism, transform the nuclear structure? By nuclear structure, he is of course referring to the core of the atom, as deduced by our experiments last year. Then he explained how he was going to seat a Gorgon on one side of a very large device he calls a cloud chamber, with big magnetic coils positioned above and below it, to see if there is some other physical phenomenon at work. I can now reveal the effects of our team's experimentation. Subject C is cooperating in a most professional manner, but despite Ernest's greatest efforts, the cloud chamber bore no fruit. She can sit with her face pressed up against the glass window on one side and blow a chicken's egg to flinders of red-hot pumice on the target stand. But no ionization trail appears in the saturated vapor of the chamber. Or rather, I should say, no direct trail appears. We had more success when we attempted to replicate other basic experiments. It seems that the Gorgon effect is a continuously variable function of the illumination of the target, with a sharply defined lower cutoff and an upper limit. By interposing smoked glass filters, we have calibrated the efficiency with which Subject C transmutes the carbon nuclei of a target into silicon quite accurately. Some of the new electrostatic counters I've been working on have proven fruitful. Secondary radiation, including gamma rays and possibly an elusive neutral particle, are given off by the target, and indeed our cloud chamber has produced an excellent picture of radiation given off by the target. Having confirmed the calorimetric and optical properties of the effect, we next performed the double-slit experiment upon a row of targets, in this case using wooden combs. A wall with two thin slits is interposed between the targets and our subject, whose gaze was split in two using a binocular arrangement of prisms. A lamp positioned between the two slits on the far side of the wall from our subject illuminates the targets, as the level of